As May draws to a close, Baltimore has seen its deadliest month since 1999. There have been 36 homicides in May, bringing the annual total to date to 109. As the death toll rises, arrests are down, and residents question police strategies. In this hour, three guests on the big challenges facing the city of Baltimore in the aftermath of the Freddie Gray case. Kevin Sherrod, a former drug dealer, now focused on getting young men away from the dangers of the street. Reverend Dante Hickman, pastor of the East Baltimore Church, where a nearly completed senior center was destroyed by fire during last month's rioting. And Wes Moore, the author and youth advocate who believes the city has reached a defining moment. The conversation on Midday after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. It's our second hour. Dan Roderick's here. I thank you again for joining us. Baltimore in its deadliest month since 1999. And, you know, the script that was written for this hour of the show says 36 homicides this month. But I have to update that number now. Baltimore Sun reporting that a woman and a young boy are now the latest homicide victims in Baltimore's deadliest month in years. Baltimore police said they responded to the 100 block of Up Manor Road in the Uplands neighborhood at 8:19 a.m. today for a report of a shooting. They found a 31-year-old woman and a boy who appeared to be about 8 years old, both shot in the head, both pronounced dead at the scene. I'm reading here from the BaltimoreSun.com story on this. Their deaths bring the total number of city homicides in May to 38, the highest monthly total since 1999, and there have now been 111 homicides in the city this year. And we've talked about this on the show this week and last week. This has been going on here for more than a month. It goes back to the end of April when we saw a surge in violence coming after the civil unrest and the night of riots and fire of April 27th. So we're going to talk about these big problems that Baltimore faces in this hour of the show today. I'm going to welcome the Reverend Dante Hickman to our discussion. Dante Hickman is pastor of Southern Baptist Church in Baltimore City, Harford, and Howard counties, but over here on the east side of town is the location where there was a fire, the fire that destroyed the Mary Harvin Transformation Center. That's the full title of it. It's a community center that has that's supposed to have affordable housing for seniors there. It was destroyed in a big fire on the night of rioting on April 27th, and we want to hear about Reverend Hickman's plans and the church's plans to rebuild there. So I welcome you to our show, Reverend Hickman. It's nice to have you on the show with us.
Dan, I'm glad to be here with you.
And Kevin Sherrod is back. Kevin Sherrod is a really interesting young guy who's spent some time in prison, 12 years in a federal prison in California. He grew up in Baltimore, became a drug dealer here, turned his life around, is now co-founder and president of the Do Right Foundation, which focuses on substance abuse prevention education, especially among young people. So it's nice to have you with us, Kevin. Nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you. Thank
Kevin Sherrod's book is Lessons on Redemption, so we'll get to talk a little bit with him about that. But let's start with the violence, if you don't mind. And Reverend Hickman, I want to hear from Kevin first on this, because you have some insights as to answer the question, maybe why. You know, this is a hard one because there are so many different stories. Yesterday I heard from James Timpson, who runs Safe Streets in Park Heights.
I know him well.
Okay.
Him well.
James said it's usually about money. Somebody's got a beef about some economic issue. Mm-hmm. Someone owes somebody some money. People are settling beefs now because they feel like the police are a bit lax. The police aren't as visible. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What are your thoughts about why we're seeing this surge now?
I think all of the above. I think that some guys feel emboldened on the streets. And then one story that hasn't been talked about much is the looting of these pharmacies around the city. And so that has created an influx of drugs on the street.
Make that connection for us. Explain that.
Well, during the looting, several pharmacies were looted around the city.
Right.
And prescription drugs sold. And usually the prescription drug of choice on the streets is Oxycontin, opiates, similar to heroin. And so the conversation that I'm hearing is that that has literally upset the market or upset the business in the streets. And so that's part of it. But the other part is guys, some guys may feel emboldened. And then the conversation about the police or their lack of working in the streets or whatever. But just think about this for a second. What officer wants to be the next officer that chases an individual down and tackles him and he hits his head and he becomes the next, you know, conversation like the Freddie Gray situation? But then I'm quite sure you have some officers that are maybe even turning the other way. Right, so you got a bunch of things going on right now that's inflaming an already fragile city, an already fragile situation, and we're just looking for answers.
You know, I've used the word crisis a couple of times.
Yeah,
with a lowercase c, but it's a crisis. I don't know. What do you think about my use of that term? Do you think Baltimore's in crisis?
I think we're in a crisis right now. It's not a crisis we haven't seen before because, you know, I've been off the streets for almost 20 years.
There's elements here that we haven't seen before.
There are.
I mean, we've seen surges in violence before.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We use the term spikes. Somebody uses the term uptick. There are surges in violence. We have a weekend where 18 or 20 people are shot. We've seen this before. But this comes on the heels of the death of Freddie Gray and all that came of that, all that surfaced because of the death of Freddie Gray. Reverend Hickman, your thought on that word crisis. Do you think we're in the midst of crisis?
I think Baltimore specifically is in the midst of a crisis of leadership. Baltimore needs innovative thinking, creative leadership, sensitive and intentional leadership that will deal with the issues that have been simmering beneath the surface for decades. This is not a quick fix situation, but we certainly have to begin to understand the demographic of our city and really deal with the felt needs of the people and the specific needs to turn around the violence that is so endemic of the culture.
Reverend Hickman, Dante Hickman, had a op-ed that appeared in the Baltimore Sun. We must redouble our efforts now that the Freddie Gray cameras are gone. It's a beautifully written piece. After reading it, a friend of mine commented, well, you can talk about poverty and all the other issues, but really this is about police brutality. This person seemed to be focused on the idea that that we're getting away from the discussion of excessive force by police, a broken relationship between police and many members of the community, and, you know, turning toward other issues like housing and poverty and the education of children, the lack of jobs and all that. How do you respond to that? What you're saying here diverts attention from the real issue, at least in the minds of this person and others.
And I think that that's precisely the diversion that some would want us to revert to. I think police brutality and excessive force is merely a symptom. It's merely a sniffle to a greater source of poverty and lack of opportunity. If you walk down any of the streets, as I have in East Baltimore, West Baltimore, and ask guys, what would it take to get you off of the streets and to not sell drugs? And most of them, if not all, have said a job and an opportunity, some training. And so if we expect our police to do the job of building community, then we're in a bad predicament. And I have to commend our police commissioner in some respects for what he's attempted to do for the limited amount of time that he's been on the job. But quite frankly, the issue is much older than him being here, but we still have to hold him accountable.
I want to tell you about a conversation I had with another friend of mine who does not buy that young guys can't find a job and that they have to sell drugs, okay? So I said to him, his name is Eddie, I said, Eddie, I'm not making an excuse for them. I'm just trying to explain to you. He wants to know, why are they out on the corner? Why are they selling drugs? Why don't they go find a job? I said, it's an easy question for you to ask, and I'm not excusing it. I'm trying to explain to you that they can't find a job that beats that one of selling, taking a chance, selling drugs and making having a fat fat roll of bills in your pocket. Kevin, help me with that one.
And okay, so two things. First of all, we have to do a better job at communicating to other people that are empowered to develop policies to understand what's really going on out there, because that's the myth.
Address Eddie, this guy that I talked to about this. He doesn't buy that, you know, young guys have to be on the corners that they could.
So nationally, unemployment nationally is roughly what, 7%?
No, it's less than that.
Right,
it's 6%. It's 5-something.
What I've seen amongst African Americans in around the country is 18-20%. So first of all, the unemployment rate is different. And second of all, I've never met a guy in the street that says, I love to be shot at. Right? I can't wait to be shot at. And the other thing is that the drug business industries is a pyramid. You have some guys at the top that are doing really, really well, and you have a ton of guys at the bottom that can make that same money working in a Walmart, right? So those are the myths that have to be debunked if we're ever going to get to better policies to deal with this situation.
The young men that you see on the street, Reverend Hickman, and you say they want a job, I say young men. Are they young men? Are they indeed under 20? Are they under 25? What would you say about them generally? I'm curious because so many of these homicide victims this month, I think I read that the median age is 23 or something of the homicide victims in May alone.
It has been a mixed populace of men that have said that. I think the young men are looking for vision for their lives, a sense of hope. I think the environment in which they live in adds to the confusion and the despair and distraction of what is possible. It is ironic that Kevin and I are meeting here today, our lives intersecting now, and we grew up in the same community. I watched him walking away from school as I was walking away from school
30 years ago.
And tell us about that, would you please? I didn't know that about you. Where are we talking about?
Well, we just bumped in each other 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago at the Greater Baltimore Committee. But we both were raised in Edmondson Village, and going to the same high school in different crews.
Edmondson High School.
And doing the same thing, and I was kicked out of that school in three high schools. And
I was kicked out of that school in three high schools.
Were you about the same age?
Yeah.
I'm 43.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm 44 now. Yeah.
Well, so that sounds like a long story, but I'd like to hear some of it. I guess we'll take a break and come back, if you don't mind sharing some of that about going from being a high school being expelled from high school.
High school knucklehead myself, being a high school knucklehead to here today. So.
Before the break, just one other question, though, because I know folks want to hear about Reverend Hickman's church and the project there, the Mary Harvin Center. So you lost the center, but then there was almost immediately, within a few days, a pledge to rebuild.
Absolutely. We sponsored and partnered with the project with the developer of our choice to come in after 9 years to do affordable housing and to do these services of workforce development training, HIV and AIDS and health screenings and services, mortgage lending services and behavioral counseling. Based on our survey of the demographic of our community, we're about restoring people as we rebuild properties. And we were fortunate because we sponsored this project with the right development team and contractor to have builders risk insurance. And what we want to share with people is this is the first of several initiatives that you cannot plant a tree and call it a garden. There's much work to be done in the community that we've laid out. And I think beyond our building and our community, this is a model for the entire city of what it takes to transform the community.
Thank you, Reverend Hickman from Southern Baptist Church. This is the Midday Show. Dan Rodericks with Reverend Dante Hickman and Kevin Sherrod. And Wes Moore will be joining us shortly. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here as we continue our conversation about Baltimore in crisis following the civil unrest this long month of May with shootings and killings in the city at a level we have not seen since 1999. A short break. We'll be right back. So we're in the middle of an interesting story there between Kevin Sherrod author of Lessons of Redemption, and Reverend Dante Hickman of Southern Baptist Church. We learned that they had both been at Edmondson High School at the same time, came up in the same, roughly the same neighborhood, and both got kicked out of Edmondson High School. And Reverend Hickman, so why don't you take it from there? I mean, I know it's a long story, but how do you go from being expelled in a high school to being a pastor of a Baptist church?
Wow. Kevin was my hero back then. He talked about the pyramid in the game. He was at the top. I was at the very bottom and the base of that. But
you were selling drugs.
Selling drugs, doing drugs, stealing cars, attempting to steal cars, assault and battery, you name it. I was caught up in that culture.
Did you go to prison?
I did not. I was fortunate after my third offense, I appeared before a judge named Joseph C. Briscoe, who would put you away on your first offense. And I had a bench warrant, and it was 4:45, and they said if my case wasn't heard, they were going to send me to jail until I awaited another court date. When I appeared before him, I lied and said that I didn't do it, the attempted stealing of a car. And he said, were you with the guys in question? And I said, yes, sir. He said, well, they plea bargained already. So are you lying? And I said, yes. And he said, well, you look like a young man that can do something with your life, go to college and graduate. I'm going to give you one more chance, give you probation and restitution on my third offense. And it was as a result of that man's decision that day that I went back to church that Sunday, gave my life to Christ, and started experiencing a call to preach. I was 16 years of age at the time. I was at my third high school at Southwestern. I was doing drugs. I eventually got put out in 1989, the year I should have graduated from the 12th grade. I only made it to the 10th grade. But that summer, because of this pressing call and this vision for my life, I sought the GED at Catonsville Community College. I passed all five parts without the assistance of a course, and I immediately enrolled in Catonsville Community College, got 22 credits in 2.5 years, failed gym, but pursued this
gym.
Ministry calling mm-hmm. and eventually met with role models, went to college at Wiley College in Texas, the movie The Great Debaters formed out of that, and saw what I could become through that historically black institution. Got B's and A's that I hadn't gotten since elementary school, made me feel like I was smart. And I challenged myself to go to a Big Ten school, Northwestern mm-hmm. University, to the seminary there, and kept succeeding through the master's, got the doctorate at Wesley at American University. And the call reshaped me, but it was from that courthouse decision from a man who looked at me based on my record and looked at my countenance and saw some potential. And that literally changed the trajectory of my life.
How many years ago now? That you were 16, you're in your early 40s now.
I'm 44 now. Yeah. That was 28 years ago.
And how long have you been an ordained minister?
I've been in ministry for 25 years.
Wow. And you said Kevin Sherrod, who's sitting also in the studio with us, was your hero. He's your hero at one point because he could sell drugs.
He could sell drugs. He had the charisma. He wore the clothes, the Jordache, the Sergio Valentes. He hung out with the A-listing crew, and he didn't recognize or know me. He was always a giant in my eyes.
And then he went away.
But you know what this brings?
He went away for 12 years in a federal prison.
Total 12 years.
Total 12.
Just about 12 years. But you know what? Real quick. This is an example of what's possible
Absolutely.
In this city. Young men on the wrong track, going down the wrong road, right? We could easily end up on the evening news, or even worse, in a body bag, and made choices at some point to say, enough is enough. I got to do something different.
But you know what I was thinking when Reverend Hickman told that story about being 16 years old mm-hmm. and a judge giving you a chance? That there might have been another 16-year-old who just didn't hear that at all and thought, okay, he's giving me another chance, so I'm out on the street and I'll just go back to what I was doing because it just doesn't impress me as much. But sure. something in you said, oh, this really is serious, or the something mm-hmm. in that judge made it clear to you that it was serious.
I think it's self-determination, and I think it's also familial reinforcement. What is your family structure and the models in your community, and the people that reaffirm those positive principles No man is an island, and you can't do it yourself. But there's a spark within each of us that can be ignited at any moment in time, and it behooves those of us who have been social climbers to be social lifters and enable that spark.
Thank you. You know, another takeaway could be when there is a moment when you have a chance to influence someone, take it. You never know what you say in a moment to a young person is going to take them one way or the other. That's a pretty powerful takeaway for me. And Kevin Sherrod, before we introduce our next guest, how did you get out of the life? What was the secret for you?
So just looking back, I attended college courses in prison. And looking back, the education was the game changer for me. Because now I realized that I could do other things with my life other than dealing drugs on the street, right? Because a lot of guys are afraid to get out of the game because they don't know what else to do.
Sure. Right? So when you came out of prison the last time, you feel like you were prepared for something else?
I was prepared, but I didn't have the confidence. And so I had to seek the confidence. So I began being mentored by some guys at the Center for Urban Families in West Baltimore, right? And actually a year later, they actually brought me back as a case manager to case manage guys being released from prison looking for jobs.
Right? Joe Jones, Moses Hammett?
And Moses Hammett, you got it right. So
you had help when you got out?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Kevin, it's nice to have you with us. And also great to have now with us in the studio, Wes Moore. Interviewed Wes Moore 5 years ago when his book, The Other Wes Moore, came out. It became a national bestseller. And since then, Wes Moore has published another book, The Work, My Search for a Life That Matters, which was published just this year.
That's right.
Wes, it's nice to see you again.
It is great to see you again.
And you've become very busy man since I saw you the last time. Yeah. You founded an organization called Bridge EDU. Tell us a little bit about that. What is Bridge EDU?
So Bridge EDU really helps to address the college completion crisis by reinventing the freshman year of college. Because one thing that we realize is that that's where we're losing a lion's share of our students who are finishing up high school. And when they move on to college, nationally, 34% of all kids that start college every year won't make it past their freshman year. And so oftentimes then you get kids who are walking around with debt and no degree.
The worst
of all scenarios.
Yes, right.
And so really what we did was we partnered, worked with institutions to include Baltimore County Community College, University of Baltimore, et cetera. And we completely restructure what the freshman year is. So we basically say, we want to make sure that there's a softer and a more personalized transition for that student. Because as we're thinking about the type of opportunities that we want to have for our kids going forward, it will include them moving on past that first degree and moving on to something else. You know, if we promise that to them, we should make it a reality for them.
Closing the achievement gap.
That's exactly right. And closing the expectation gap.
So, Wes, I have to tell you, just before you got in here, we were sharing the stories of, hearing the stories of Reverend Hickman and Kevin Sherrod, and I didn't realize that the two of them knew each other way back when they were teenagers in Edmondson Avenue, Edmondson Village, Edmondson High School. Yeah. And they both got kicked out of school. And so that story must sound a little bit familiar to you as well, right?
When we walked in, we said, must be the kicked out of school crew. I feel like we're in detention right now today.
I didn't expect that as a theme, but it's pretty interesting.
We're in the principal's office.
So just remind us what happened to you.
Yeah, so you know, it's funny because I always tell people I fail Baltimore 101 because the most important question is where'd you go to high school? Right. I never made it to high school in Baltimore because I was sent away.
Right.
When I was 13 years old, I had a mandatory year in military school. Up in Pennsylvania because of some trouble I got into.
Valley Forge
Military Academy. And I mean, I hated every minute of that place when I first got there. I ran away 5 times in the first 4 days. You know, every time I got a chance, they turned their back and I was running out of the gates. And it's interesting because I remember the second last time I tried to run away, they found me at 1 o'clock in the morning in the middle of the woods. And I was crying because I just wanted to get home more than anything else. And they sent me back to campus. And they let me make one phone call, and I called the only number that I knew, which was my mom.
Wow.
And when I called her, I was, you know, telling her, I was like, "Mommy, can you come get me tomorrow morning? I'll go to school more often. I'll do whatever you need me to do." And that's when she said to me, she said, "Too many people are fighting for you, and too many people are proud of you, and you've got to understand this is not all about you." And nothing changed.
Did you
that
understand
night.
What she meant by that?
No, I say that at that night, nothing changed. But I think as I finally started to give this thing a shot, And as I realized how many people were fighting for me, and that we live in a big and a beautiful and a bright world, and that it actually had a place for me too, it changed my perspective, and I realized how smart she actually was.
Did you embrace the Academy after that?
I think by not at first. I mean, that first year was hard, and it's intentionally hard. I mean, their goal is they're going to break you down as an individual because they want to build you up as a team.
So what do you think changed? What changed your direction?
You know, I think a big thing for me was the introduction of leadership. And even I think about the work that we do right now with Bridge EDU, that's a big component to what we have. And what I mean by that is this, is, you know, when you first get there, after breaking you down, they're going to very quickly and put you in charge of something. And it's going to be something small. They're going to say, okay, Moore, you're now in charge of this hallway. If the hallway's clean, we'll congratulate you. And if the hallway's dirty, then Lord help you. Right. And let's say Hickman is in my squad and I see Hickman eating a bag of Doritos and throwing the Doritos on the hallway. Well, I'm scooping him up because I'm like, hey, I'm not going to get in trouble because you can't find a trash can. And they notice that. Like, oh, it's clean. Good job, Moore. Now we'll make you a squad leader. And now I have these five people who I'm in charge of. And let's say, you know, let's say Sherrod shows up 5 minutes late for class. The teacher's not going to ask Sherrod, why are you late? The teacher's going to walk up to him and say, Sherrod, who's your squad leader? And they're going to come find me. And they're going to say to me, Sherrod was 5 minutes late for my class today. Why? And I need to have an answer. So the only guarantee I can give them is that, sir or ma'am, Sherrod will be 5 minutes early for class tomorrow. And I'll make sure of that. So there's this graduated sense of responsibility. And where this plays into, I think, a lot of what happens and things we're talking about in the first hour was, you know, let's not pretend that when they first started talking to us and recruiting us at 8 years old, it was not to be kingpins. It was to be lookouts. They give you something small to do. And they see how you do, and your job is to be a lookout, scream out the name of the day, and when someone comes by the neighborhood, whatever, they notice you do that well, then your job is to become a runner. You get promoted, right? And then your job is to move a package from one side of town to another side of town. The reason they do that is because cops generally don't check a 9-year-old with a book bag. And then you keep on getting promoted. You become a cash kid. You become a houseman. You become muscle. You become a lieutenant, whatever the case is. So when people tell me how complicated these structures are, the answer I always have for them is there's nothing complicated about them. They've simply taken the same structure of Fortune 500 companies and military organizations, and they have made them their own. And so if we can't find
drugs.
That's exactly right. So if we can't find a way to penetrate and essentially change the product, then we are going to be having a losing battle for a very long time.
I remember having a conversation with a young man who sold cocaine in Baltimore, and he explained his whole organization to me, how he operated. It was very complicated, but he understood it. It was his idea, and it was very effective because he eluded arrest for a long time. And I remember thinking, you should be running a car dealership.
Exactly,
you should be
right.
Running a chain of stores or something. You have that acumen, you know.
You look at so many of these young people, Dan. It's like they are entrepreneurial, they are fearless, they are creative. They've got a whole battery of skills that if we can just figure out another way to target it. I mean, look out.
I mentioned that in this bloody month of May, the median death of the median age of a homicide victim is 23 years old. So how do you reach in there? Reverend Hickman started talking about this, about young guys on the corner saying they wanted a job. Mm-hmm. But Wes Moore, I mean, your city is in your native city is in a crisis here. I don't know even where to begin. How do you reach in and pull someone out of that dysfunction? How do you pull them out of that life and say, you know, there's something better for you when they don't see that? They're in an environment that's just where all these ideas are foreign.
Well, I think part of we have a bigger challenge. We have a thought challenge, and then we have a structural challenge, right? The thought challenge is not even that they don't see it, is that they don't feel it. You know, they don't feel that the community is connected to them at all. We don't have a larger youth strategy in the way we're going to help out young people. It's very patchwork. And I think my mother said it best when she said, kids need to think that you care before they care what you think. And right now we have a lot of young people who think we don't care about their lives nor their future, so they could care less about what's coming out of
our
house.
They don't get that in school? I mean, the modern school. I mean, the Baltimore City schools of 2015, the public schools. Yeah. You don't think that they get that there?
Well. Also,
I ask any of you, Reverend Hickman, it seems to be the place to provide it.
To apply modernity to the communal facilities that we have now, I think is not accurate. I think there's so much dilapidation and disinvestment in our communities, the environments themselves, and the blight that is in our environment. Feeds into the psyche. If you live in a rat-infested neighborhood, and you go to a school where you have unhealthy drinking water, you live in a home that has lead paint in it, because these homes have existed for 80 and 100 years, it plays into your psyche. And it's easy for a person that lives in a gated community, who has the meal preparation, who doesn't have to live in that type of environment. Our environments are survival for children. And to have a survivor's mentality and then be expected to have a mind open to learning is very, very difficult. And then you take recreation away, you take any healthy form of facility away for young people. I think it's a recipe for failure. And this is, you know, in Centralia, Pennsylvania, I was reading about coal mine fires that have been burning
forever
yeah. beneath the surface and yeah. leaving large potholes where people could be swallowed and cars are swallowed up, and the town is nearly destroyed. And the same thing in Colorado, where it only would cost $6.5 million to eliminate or extinguish the fire, and yet it's still not extinguished. I wonder, do we have the will in the business community, the Merle Lynches and the Leg Masons? I was glad to hear David Warnock the other day at the GBC articulate the need to link the social with the structural development. And we need to press and hear more of that kind of leadership and innovation, especially as it relates to our young people.
Reverend Dante Hickman from Southern Baptist Church in East Baltimore, I just want to say, just driving around your area, where your church is, up North Broadway, up that way, it seems like you and Humanum at the American Brewery have stuck a flag in the ground and said, yeah, there isn't much around us here. You know, a lot of people don't think about us over here in this part of East Baltimore, but we're here to stay. We're doing our thing here. We're not going to leave. That's the impression I get from where you are.
That's the right impression. And Dan, when we initially built the Cole Grant Higgs Senior Housing Facility, people said this would be a failed investment. Nobody is investing in this community. And Southern Baptist Church invested the first million that garnered a $12 million tax credit to put that building there. It's been fully occupied and has had a waiting list. As a result, the developer of that project, Bill Struver, walked across the street into the American Brewery and saw a building that had been there for 30 years without investment, saw the success of the senior center, and because the church that stayed as a stakeholder, and brought Humanum. And they were able to get $22 million invested. And that catalyst said to us, when I became pastor 12 years ago, let's go across the street and let's develop more, not just houses and brick and mortar, because we have to invest in human capital. If we just invest in brick and mortar, we'll see dilapidation all over again. And it's this type of catalyst development, and elimination of blight and affordable housing and amenities and services that will do the transformation that's necessary and blur the lines of the East Baltimore Development Initiative with Johns Hopkins that cut off at the railroad tracks.
Right.
They thought it was a dividing line, wow. And it's just up the street and down the street, and connect to the community's asset of Clifton Park. It is this type of contiguous development that I think can shift Baltimore, decentralizing the poverty in the community, providing the needed services and resources and new housing stock that can make a major difference in our city.
Reverend Dante Hickman, our guest for the remainder of the hour, along with Wes Moore and Kevin Sherrod. If you'd like to join us, please give us a ring, 410-662-8780. A short break here on Midday. We'll be right back. Also, our email address, if you have comments and you want me to read them on the air, midday@wypr.org. Welcome back. 410-662-8780. Wes Moore's latest book is The Work, My Search for a Life That Matters. That follows his 2010 bestseller, The Other Wes Moore. Kevin Sherrod's book is Streets of Redemption?
Lessons of Redemption.
Sorry. Lessons from the Street, of Redemption. I'm just kidding. It's called, again, Lessons of Redemption.
Yes.
Your story coming up in Baltimore, turning into a drug dealer, getting out of that life.
Getting out of that
and,
life.
And Kevin, yep. Thank you very much. So Kevin, I'll ask you this, and then I'll ask of Wes Moore and Reverend Hickman a couple of things following our conversation here. This is what I hear, the last few weeks especially, by email, comments in social media. Too many dysfunctional families in the African American neighborhoods of Baltimore City. We can't be expected to fix all of that. It's too complicated. They should take care of themselves. They're to blame. They are to blame for the homicides. So many young men in the life and in prisons. We've done enough. I'm telling you, this is what comes in. And so I want to get your response to that. I'm sure you've heard this before.
Oh, yeah. And so until we get away from this mentality of those people or their problem, because the riot or the uprising, whatever we want to call it, that became our problem, right? So at one point it was their problem, and then later on it became our problem, right?
Who's our? You mean the city of Baltimore.
The city of Baltimore.
And you refer in your op-ed that you had in the Sun, Wes Moore, as us. Mm-hmm. He defines us.
Right.
But anyway,
right.
Go ahead, Kevin. Yeah.
Until we get away from that mentality. And the other thing, when did we get into the business of throwing away human beings? When did we get in the business of throwing away some of the people that need the help the most? Right. When we start having that mentality, that thinking, that's going to just take us backwards, because there's a lot of potential in that area of Baltimore. This opportunity for Baltimore to change, to show the country, not just the country, the world. I talk to people all across the country about what's going on in Baltimore, and there are a lot of eyes on Baltimore right now. We can show the country and the world that change is possible, and that you can have a crisis and turn that crisis around, and next thing you know, you're a model for the world. But we got to get away from I call it the stinking thinking, right? Of it's those people's problem. Because at some point, those people's problem will become our problem, just the way it did a few weeks ago.
Wes Moore, in the op-ed that you had published in the Sun, you say this is a defining moment for the city.
It's a defining moment because the next 12 months will help determine the next 12 years. Very much in terms of how the world thinks about us, but also how we think about ourselves. And that's the amazing thing. You know, there's when you look at what's happening in Baltimore, and not just the heartbreak, but the things that people are doing, where we have a collection of citizens who are not waiting for permission anymore. They're just doing. They're not waiting for an edict or a certain responsibility or a job title to go and make a big difference in their communities. They're already doing it. And the amazing thing, when we think about, like, as Kevin was saying, what happened with whether it be Soundtown or a collection of other neighborhoods, is we need to make sure that the people that we are trying to support in this, that they are actually part of the conversation and not just subjects of the conversation. And oftentimes when that happens, that gets interpreted as something other than benevolent. Mm-hmm. It gets interpreted as something other than kind. And when we think about this stuff, and we see people are doing it, I mean, you look at what's happening, you know, take anchor institutions like, you know, what the University of Maryland is doing over with Hollis Market and Poppleton, right? Where you're actually getting the Southwest Partnership involved in that conversation and saying, yes, we can have development and growth, but we need to make sure that it's community-oriented development and growth. You look at the work that Reverend Hickman's doing. You look at the work that, you know, Munir Bahar is doing. People who are saying, we're not waiting for someone else to give us instructions nor directions. Mm-hmm. And when we have that conversation from other people who say, well, you know, we've tried this, we've tried that, and they haven't figured it out. It reminds me of a conversation that I remember I had with Wes, the other Wes Moore, where we were speaking about Baltimore. This was years ago. And I asked him, I said, so do you think that we're products of our environments? Talking about where we came up in Baltimore and that type of thing. And he looked at me and he said, actually, I think we're products of our expectations. And I thought to myself, he is absolutely right.
Wow. If you have low expectations, the bar's pretty low. You reach that, you're done, right?
And the expectations that we have of ourselves, they don't come from nowhere. They come from the expectations that other people have of us. So we can sit there and poo-poo, and we can sit there and push to the side all we want. But understanding that poo-pooing and that pushing to the side, it is not going unnoticed.
Mm. Reverend Hickman, so another question, another thing I hear, Sandtown, Winchester, since we mentioned that a couple of times, it's where Freddie Gray came up and where he was arrested, and it's got a lot of attention, a lot of analysis. People look at the numbers, you know, the investment that was made there in the 1990s, James Rouse leading that effort there, Mayor Kurt L. Schmoke. And another thing you hear is, well, look at all that investment and what good did it get? What good did it get us? You still have a high concentration of poverty, high unemployment, high incarceration rate among people who came up in Sandtown, Winchester. So what more do you want? What more can we do? It didn't work. It's a failure.
I think the research on the front end may have been the failure. Was there a demographic analysis of who the people were and what were the human and social needs of that community? I don't think you can rebuild just looking at the housing and the brick and mortar. It's beyond brick and mortar. It's beyond policing. I believe that there's a human aspect. How do we train people? Baltimore is mostly now a renting populace, and we want to create affordable housing. But how do you turn a renter into a homeowner? Because there is a bridge, and we need to provide the types of services to people that they can lease for a period of time while they build equity, and you train people so that they can take ownership of that home. I think the mental health issues, that we're not providing mental health care, life coaching, behavioral counseling. We're trading drugs for drugs. We're providing them with methadone clinics. That is the worst thing, in my opinion, that could have ever happened to our communities. So we're writing them off. And I'm not asking for welfare, although our countercultural parts are, when they get welfare, it's called corporate bailouts. And the community does need assistance and bailouts. I think there's a shared accountability on both respects. And I think that young men have to take responsibility for their actions, but they can't take responsibility and then run into a wall where there's no opportunity.
Let's take a couple of phone calls while we can in this hour of the show. Jenor, calling in from Columbia. Thanks. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you. I was just talking about, having worked in the prison system, one of the things that I find, the young people had no role models except the people who are dealing drugs, because that's what they say. So I'm thinking that if more churches, like the gentleman there is talking, become community advocates and role models for the children, then we would lessen the incarceration rate. Because personally, I don't think the politicians are going to answer to whoever has the loudest mouth about what they want.
I had a question. It brings up a question. Thank you, Jenna, for Reverend Hickman, because we think of, you know, the pastors having great power in the city, influence on people, certainly among their flock and the people who attend church and listen to your sermons. But what about those young men on the street? Do they listen to you? Do you have their ears?
Absolutely. And we discovered that on the night that the chaos ensued. I received a call from Pastor Harold Carter that he was going back to New Shiloh to be in his office to, you know, see what could be done. And while hearing a call from him, I answered a text from one of the police, Lieutenant Colonel Russell, saying, "Pastors, we need you on the street." When I arrived in the office, there were other pastors there, and I said, "It's time for us to get in the street. Let's go out there." And many of them were absolutely against it. Nobody was really for it, besides Elder Ron Owens.
None were in favor of getting into the
getting
street during
the
that time?
Because they felt like we did not have a plan, and what can we do? And I said, our presence can quell the chaos. And one actually said, "But these people may not, they don't know us. We know their parents, but they don't know us." And I said, that would be an indictment on us if they don't know us.
Yeah.
And as a result, we forced the issue in the press conference. I made the announcement that we were going into the streets. And by that time, hundreds more had gathered. And we got in the streets, we marched, we prayed, we sang, and we noticed that people throughout the neighborhood were excited about our presence. Gang members literally drove up in their pickup truck and said, man, we respect y'all for this. Man, we want to be with y'all. This is important. We need y'all out here. The police literally came to us and said, we can't get to a fire up the street.
Now, what I mean is that gang member who in that moment is happy to see you may not be happy to see you some other time. And I wonder about the pastor's influence to the caller's question about, you know, on the street, on the corner, these young men who are dying in May. Can you get them out of that life?
I think so. I think we can identify with them if we would be empathetic and not insulated in the church and in the robes that are so disconnected from where they are. And we say, hey, I've not always been in this pulpit. This is where I come from, the same neighborhood that you grew up in. And they identify with the story. And in the old vernacular, game recognizes game. They know authenticity when they see it and where you come from. And they will allow you access to speak to them where they are. And we've had that experience.
Well, and I would just compound on that. You know, game recognizes game, and also love recognizes love. Yeah. You know, they know the reason that they will respond and the reason they can work. And again, we were out in the evenings and we saw this, and I was so pleasantly, not surprised, but just so pleasantly taken by the influence that the minister had in all this. Yeah. And it was because when these young people, when our young people, when they feel like that people are coming from a place of love, and they're coming from a place of concern, the reaction is going to be different if they felt like you're coming from another type of place.
Sure.
And that's where this influence really does matter, and where you can actually pull them from one place to another, because they know that your heart is in that right place.
And that was revealed to all of us, including myself, who wanted to step out there, into the ministers who were there. When we were in the street, we felt the ethos. We felt the change. We felt the impact and the influence that many of us didn't know we really had.
Because they want help.
They're
looking for help. They're looking for somebody to come into their life and support them. And sometimes that male ego gets in the way, and a guy won't tell you, look, man, I'm in trouble. Mm. I don't want this life no more. I want to get out, right? But the other thing is that he don't know how to.
Right.
Right? And so you guys showing up.
You're showing interest in a young man.
And that's all these guys want. And I'm quite sure.
Really,
it's no doubt in my mind you saved many lives and may not even realize it. And I'm quite sure you saved many lives and don't even realize it. These guys want support. They want help.
Yes. We have time for one more quick question from a listener. This is Owen in Baltimore. Owen, go right ahead and ask your question.
How you doing? Thank you for taking my question.
Yeah, go right ahead. Yeah.
One is to Wes Moore. I understand Wes Moore. That the city fathers have met with you. And before I say what they've met with you about, just let me say this real quick.
Owen, we're short of time, so just please ask your question.
Okay, if the city fathers met with you, and I understand they met with you to run for mayor, I think you can follow the Tom Brady model in California. When he was asked, before he was asked to run for mayor, they came to a guy named H.H. Brook and said, run. He said, no, I can find somebody. I've never thought about a preacher as a politician, but I think Wes Moore, you may have found one in Reverend Hickman.
Okay.
Because this guy's actually doing the work on the streets. He's not just writing a book, but his hands are transforming lives, and that whatever his name is, the Hickman man, he can think.
Reverend Dante Hickman, Wes Moore, and Kevin Sherrod. So interested in political office, either one of you? Wes, I know you get that question a lot. But we're really close to being done here, I'm sorry to say.
I have a passion for Baltimore, and I'd serve in whatever capacity I can.
That leaves that open-ended, didn't it? Wes Moore?
I can definitively say I am not running for political office, but I'm going to be a very active citizen, and I'm following my path with Bridget E.U. in this work.
Very good.
And my goal is president. So
Kevin Sherrod?
We haven't gotten there yet.
I didn't
get
to you.
That's my goal.
Thank you, Kevin. Well, it's good to have that. You got to set the bar high, right?
Set the bar high.
All right. Kevin Sherrod's book, again, is Lessons of Redemption, published by Perfect Publishing. Nice to have you back on the show, Kevin. And Wes Moore, founder and CEO of Bridge EDU, is a bestseller, The Other Wes Moore, and now The Works. Thank you very much. Thank you, Reverend Hickman.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And my book is entitled The Power of Being Underestimated, Allowing the Negatives to Work for Your Good.
Oh, I didn't know you had a book. I've learned something during this hour. It's great. Thank you very much for being here, all of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks for tuning in, folks. We'll see you again for Midday Friday.